Well, what I thought I'd begin with is Jenin and what Israel and much of the Western media calls the operation. It's a bit like Ukraine, isn't it? Special military operation. It has been pointed out that operations are normally done with the patient's consent, and they're normally performed for the patient's benefit. So I think both in the case of Ukraine and in the case of Jenin, that is what you call a euphemism. What we actually have, of course, in the context of the West Bank is an Israeli occupation, but also an Israeli occupation that has a colonizing purpose. And you know, all you need to do is look at this operation, as they call it, and just look at the inequality involved. And I think that's important when it comes to the discussion, which I'll lead into, of solution or the various solutions on offer. On the one side, we seem to have a, I don't know whether it's an official alliance, I suspect it's an unofficial alliance between young men in Hamas, young men in Islamic Jihad, and young men in Fatah, on the one side armed with AK-47s. And on the other, we had an incursion of 2,000 Israeli troops backed up with drones, with armored cars, with rockets launched from the air, with bulldozers, basically ramming in order to arrest, to eliminate these terrorists, i.e., people who dare to resist an occupation force, an occupation force that's been there since 1967 in the case of the West Bank, and also an occupation force that has been colonizing the land. I think there are something like 500,000 settlers on the West Bank as we speak now. And if you know, it's an old illustration of it, but nonetheless, it is just worthwhile looking at the map of Palestine stroke Israel since 1947-48. And look how progressively Israel has expanded into what we now think of Israel proper, but also how it's expanded, how it's annexed the Golan Heights up in terms of Syrian territory, but also how it's divided up, split up the West Bank. So what we now have on the West Bank isn't some block of territory that's occupied by Israeli forces. What we have is remaining pockets of Palestinian territory that are increasingly surrounded by Israeli settler territory as the land is expropriated by them. And so what we have in terms of the West Bank is the ghettoization or the reduction of the Palestinian population into a series of disconnected reservations. And I choose that particular analogy for good reason. All we need to do is think about what happened to the native population into the in the United States to understand what Israel has in mind. Of course, Israel nowadays doesn't use the language of colonization. That's no longer fashionable. So when we, you know, when we read the material of the Jewish labor movement and other such organizations, what they now use is the language of national liberation. that somehow the Jewish masses freed themselves in Israel stroke Palestine, as opposed to come in to Israel stroke Palestine as outsiders, as colonizers. And that's been a powerful narrative. And so, you know, you meet ordinary British people, not Jewish people, not people who are particularly political, and they'll have in their heads that Israel somehow has the right to this land, because at least in terms of my generation, at least, you know, we were brought up as Christians who read the Old Testament and the New Testament, and we associate Jewish people with the land of Israel. The fact would be, you know, for what it's worth, and it isn't worth very much, that the in terms of the original inhabitants of this land, they're much more likely to be Palestinians in terms of biological descent, as if it matters, than people from the United States or Russia or Poland or wherever they happen to come from. Okay. So where do we trace back this question? I certainly don't trace it back, you know, 2,000 years ago, you know, the Roman siege of Jerusalem and the mythical, entirely mythical clearing of the native population from the land. That simply didn't happen. No, we need to trace this particular question back, I think. If we're going to do it to any particular day, I think we need to trace it back to 1917. Why? Because if we look at Zionism, Zionism has been around as some sort of idea for a long, long time, the return to the homeland, entertained by this or that religious fanatic. But when we're talking about modern Zionism, we're talking about something that comes into existence when, roughly speaking, 1880s, 1890s, but it didn't become a practical proposition until the Zionist movement could get an imperial backer. And we know all about them trying to get the backing of the Ottomans. We know that they tried to get the backing of the Tsarist authorities on the basis, well, you know, we both want Jews out of Russia. But the great advantage of 1917 and doing a deal with the British, which is what happened with the Balfour Declaration, is that the British and the French and before them, Russia were engaged with a war with the Central Powers, which not only included Germany, Austro-Hungary, but the Ottoman Empire. And you know, each three had their plans about how to dismember the Ottoman Empire. So we know that the Tsarists were going to get Constantinople, Istanbul. That would give them access to the warm waters of the Mediterranean. And we know the Anglo-French alliance divided up what you could call Arabia. And that included the Syrian province of what is now Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, I think, but certainly Palestine. And as I said, the great advantage, as far as the Zionists were concerned, is having Britain as its sponsor. Britain was in charge of so-called Mandate Palestine and could allow Jewish migration to happen and to give that migration protection, imperial protection. What was the aim? The aim was to create a little version of Ulster in the Middle East. And of course, we know that the imperial sponsor changed. So in 67, when we had the Six-Day War, the Israeli so-called Defense Force was equipped in terms of its high-end tech, its you know, its aircraft. They were French. Its tanks were French. We know that Israel gets its nuclear bomb technology from the French, but we also know that 67 is the moment where Israel switches in terms of its imperial sponsor to the United States, the global hegemon. So it goes from Britain to Britain and France to France, and then to the United States. And yes, we've heard endlessly since 67 from the United States, from Britain, from various other European powers about this so-called two-state solution. We all know the pictures, the record of Yasser Arafat signing this historic peace agreement. But we also know that from an Israeli point of view, any sort of Palestinian state worthy of the name is completely unacceptable. It's simply not going to be allowed. Why? Because although, at least in its origin, Zionism was a strictly secular ideology, it always had the view that somehow this was God's given territory to the Jews, and that this Israel would be the homeland for Jews all the way around the world, in New York, in London, in Kiev, wherever Jews happened to be, this was their homeland. And quite frankly, if you look at what that homeland is meant to be, it does vary. And so if you look at some Zionists, some of the more fanciful ones, look back at the entirely mythical kingdom of Solomon and say it's from the river to the river. And what they mean by that is the river Tigris to the river Nile. That was purportedly Solomon's kingdom. Either way, as a practical proposition, you could certainly imagine Israel incorporating all of Mandate Palestine. The problem that Israel, of course, has, if it actually does that, is called people. And the people are Palestinians. And as things stand at the present time, if they did incorporate all of Palestine into a greater Israel, roughly speaking, there would be 50-50 population between Palestinians and Hebrews, Israeli Jews, call them what you will. And of course, what we would then have is a situation where roughly half the population viewed themselves as colonized. If they were allowed the vote, they clearly wouldn't be voting for Zionism, Zionist parties, and the Zionist project would be completely ineffective. So what to do about the Palestinians? And we've seen that in 47, 48, mass expulsions. Well, to do that, you have to wait for the right political conditions. Meanwhile, you make life, and that's what's going on now, as unpleasant as possible. And that's clearly the project of the present day coalition, but it's not simply the present day far right coalition. It was also the project of Labour Zionism that actually led, Moshe Dayan, Golda Meir, and all those who took the land in 67. Okay, so just a couple of things on Israel-Palestine, because of course this is going on at the same time as in Britain. The government is pushing through Parliament anti-BDS, anti-boycott sanctions and disinvestment measures. This legislation is quite difficult for them on one level, because they have to distinguish between the principle which they are putting forward, which is the idea that local authorities shouldn't have their own foreign policy. I sort of asked the question of why not? And then they have to distinguish between what's good foreign policy and what's bad foreign policy, because of course, local authorities are allowed, in terms of this new legislation, to boycott Belarus, Lukashenko and all that sort of stuff. And they're allowed to boycott the Russian Federation, Putin, and oligarchs and all such other things. You would presume also Donbass, Crimea, whatever. But they're having to distinguish between these two. Quite clearly, this is a piece of reactionary legislation. And therefore, I flag up the last parliamentary vote, which was on Monday. And we had, 268 for this legislation, 70 against. It wasn't because it was a Monday, by the way, at least I don't think so. And the House of Commons was, thinly populated. You had such a small vote. The Labour Party line, the official line of the PLP, was to abstain. And to their disgrace, that seems to have been what the majority of the so-called socialist campaign group did. Only 10 of them joined the 70 vote against. That does say something, doesn't it? Something disgraceful, not only about the Labour Party, but also about the so-called Labour left. Now, I just want to go on very briefly to the question that I raised earlier, and that's what is put forward as the solution. I've already dealt with the, the high bourgeoisie, the imperialist bourgeoisie, America, Britain, the EU. They all wave the flag for a two-state solution. No one seriously believes it. And if they did believe it once, way back when, you know, Camp David and all the rest of it, they certainly don't believe it now. So I think myself that it was always a cynical piece of nonsense. Yes, what they managed to do is constitute the Palestinian Authority as the sort of pliant police force for the West Bank and Gaza. Okay, since then we've seen Hamas. Either way, on the West Bank, what you have is a Palestinian Authority that's subsidized by the EU, acts on behalf of the imperialist powers, but also acts on behalf, objectively, of the colonizing power itself. On the other hand, there is a Palestinian version of the two-state solution and a left-wing version of the two-state solution. But, you know, frankly, since we've seen, decade after decade after decade of Israeli colonization and a progressive shift to the right in Israel politically, quite frankly, that two-state solution just comes over as completely idealistic or a fantasy. Call it whatever you will, it's clearly not practical politics, because you have to ask, with all of this, who enforces it? So that really does take me back, you know, to why the Zionist project went from being a dream that it was in the 1880s, 1890s, to practical politics. It was the sponsorship of British imperialism looking to create its own Jewish version of Ulster in the Middle East. And Ulster in the Middle East, because we were shifting in terms of, big power politics from the age of coal to the age of oil. And under Churchill, the British Navy, for example, converted from coal ships, which required coaling stations all the way around the world, to oil, which means much more mobility, much more, ships that can go further, last longer out there on the oceans. And of course, the Middle East has abundant supplies of oil. Either way, the point is there that in terms of the Zionist project, they needed an imperial backer. So we need to ask the same question about a two-state solution. Who is going to impose it? And one thing that we can be sure of is that the United States isn't. It pays lip service to it. Meanwhile, it actually subsidizes Israel, that is engaged in an active policy of colonization, that if one wants to draw an analogy, something, you know, along the lines of Australia or the United States or a New Zealand, why draw that analogy? Simply because what we're dealing with here is a work colony, i.e. the colonizers actually supply the workforce. This isn't an exploitation colony of where the colonialists supply the supervisors while the natives do the grunt labor. So this isn't a version of South African colonization, even though we do have an Israeli version of apartheid, i.e. An occupied Palestinian population, but also a second class Arab Palestinian population in so-called Israel proper. Okay, so other comrades on the left, including on the Palestinian left, put forward the idea of a single state solution. That's still the position of Hamas. It's the position that used to be upheld by Fatah. It's also the position of much of the left in Britain. So, for example, the Socialist Workers' Party. Again, I come back to the problem with this. And that is, first of all, who is going to impose it? And that is clearly a problem at the present time. And I think that that problem was illustrated by Janine, that there you are, you've got young men fighting with Kalashnikovs against an Israel that's armed to the teeth, and behind it, it has the backing of the imperial hegemon. What is a Palestinian, benefiting one state solution? Who's backing that? Well, we could have a one state solution, but as I said, either that means apartheid in the whole of this greater Israel, or the mass expulsion of the Palestinian population, or perhaps even the sort of extermination colonization that we did see in the United States and in Australia, for example. So if you take the SWP, they would claim that what you'd have is a single democratic state of Palestine, where there'll be equal rights for all people in Israel, but they actually don't mean it. And if you look at their single state solution, what they have is equal religious and cultural rights for the peoples involved. They don't have, and you can see why, the right of self-determination, national self-determination. And that takes you either into the territory of denying the nationhood of the Israeli Jewish population or the Hebrew population, or some nonsense that they're all the same people or something like that. Clearly, from any Democrat's point of view, a forceful unity of the Palestinian people taking over and suppressing the Israeli Jewish population is unacceptable. You know, the idea of unity imposed at the point of a bayonet isn't a democratic solution as far as we would be concerned. And that's the reality behind the SWP's call for a single state solution. But the problem is that without the ability to deliver it. And that's why you have to go, I think, for a regional solution of one sort or another. There are many different recipes available. You know, we can't really sit here now and say it will be this, that, or the other. That's up to the future to supply. So, yeah, it could be a socialist federation of the Middle East of some sort. It could be the Arab Revolution, you know, led by the working class, I hasten to add, you know, the national reunification of the Arabic speaking peoples, which the Israeli Jews would be offered some sort of federated relationship with, or something along those lines, a return to a greater Syria, whatever the solution is. But in practical terms, it has to involve a shift in the global balance of forces, and therefore, you know, the proletariat acting as a great power, which is what it could have done and what it was doing in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So if we look at the question of a regional solution, you have to say that since the 60s, since the 70s, that now appears to be further off than it did then, simply because what you have to do is come up, I think at least, with some solution that offers the possibility of offering something positive to the Israeli Jewish population, offering them subordinate status, I don't think is a winner, offering them equal rights, including the right to secede, including the right to self-determination, and if necessary, separation. That is something that isn't something that communists would advocate in a positive sense, but it is something that communists would advocate as an insurance policy, that if you're worried about being dominated, then you have an opt-out clause. It's called the potentiality of divorce. We don't go around to married couples and advocate that they get divorced, but we do say that married couples ought to have the right to divorce. The two are clearly distinct and different. Nonetheless, that needs to be emphasized. Okay. Last point. For those that think that you can find a solution within Israel or within Israel-Palestine, and all you need to do is link up with the Israeli Jewish, the Hebrew population, and broaden the anti-Netanyahu protest movement, you know, Netanyahu and the Supreme Court and judges and all the rest of it, and his extreme right-wing coalition. Well, just note that the organizers of those protests, instantly the Israeli Defense Force went into Jenin. They offered the IDF their solidarity. I think that should tell us something about the nature of the class politics within Israel proper. They are not simply left-right. It's much more complex than that. And it's equivalent, you know, and we did hear it, of course, when it came to Northern Ireland, those on the left that simply said Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, nationalists and loyalists, you're all workers, all unite. It hasn't worked to date. It's unlikely to work in the future. Why? Because what we have in terms of the Protestant stroke loyalist population in the north of Ireland and in Israel is a labor aristocracy. And we need a strategy that can overcome that. And the only strategy, at least I can think of precisely, is the regional approach, which isn't an, you know, a magic wand, but at least it has the virtue of not being utopian, of not being just a foolish dream or just crass economism. It deals with high politics. It deals with global politics. And as I say, you have to deal at the level of the hegemon power itself when you're looking at Israel-Palestine. There are no solution in any narrow piece of geography. Okay, moving on, I think I should be halfway through, give it an hour. Ukraine, I didn't notice it, but Zelensky did. 500 days since the outbreak of the special military operation. I'll call it what it is, a war. But it isn't simply a war between the invading Russians. Yes, Russia invaded, but it's also a proxy war between Russia and NATO. And of course, we're not going to have NATO membership for Ukraine. I know that Turkey is now talking about it, at the same time blocking Sweden. I'm not sure what's going on there. Again, I don't know what happened about the Azov Brigade, the commanders captured in Mariupol being put into Ukrainian hands by the Erdogan regime. Something's going on there. I don't know what. Hopefully we'll get an article in this week's Weekly Worker from Comrade Essen. Maybe he'll be able to explain it. Either way, 500 days. And what does Zelensky do? He goes to Snake Island. Remember Snake Island? This was the incident when the Russians occupied Snake Island. Remember, they've got the Black Sea Fleet. Ukraine, I think, had a couple of boats. Russia had a fleet, so they just simply went in onto Snake Island. When they were asked to surrender, when the Ukrainian forces were asked to surrender, remember the famous reply, it was, and I have got no hesitation in using good old Anglo-Saxon, fuck off. And the Russians bombarded these guys, killed them. And so Zelensky was on Snake Island, very fast boat, very quick visit to pay homage to these heroes, put flowers on their grave and to scuttle out as quick as possible. And I was told at the time, and I'm not saying this for any nasty reason, but I was told at the time that Snake Island was a strategic victory, either by Russia, I can't remember which, or by Ukraine taking it back. And I just said, no, no, no. It's of symbolic value. And okay, Ukraine took it back by getting rid of the Russians. That's true. But are they going to station, you know, some garrison on Snake Island? No. Of course not. Is Snake Island going to be used as a naval base to tackle the Russian fleet in the Black Sea? No, of course not. So, yeah, we had the presidential visit, the ceremony and all the rest. And that's been my argument all the way along about Bakhmut, that when the Wagner forces took it, that had symbolic value. But notice that the commanders of Wagner didn't then say, right, now we march on Kiev. No, they said, we've done our job and we're going on holiday now. And did the Russian army charge onwards and ever further into Ukrainian territory? Of course not. It was always of symbolic value. And of course, what the Ukrainians would have done while that city was under siege is to prepare for the loss of that city by digging and preparing defences that if Russia wanted to advance, it would be stopped. So it is feasible just about that under the present so-called spring offensive, we're now well into summer, that Ukraine could retake that city, but this wouldn't then set the stage for the collapse of Russian lines and have Russian soldiers running all the way back to the border. No, of course it wouldn't. That if Zelensky's forces retook Bakhmut, the wreck of Bakhmut, it would be symbolic, and that's all it's been. And what you've had is both sides being willing to sacrifice the lives of tens of thousands of soldiers for what isn't of military strategic value at all. I'm not saying symbolism, by the way, doesn't matter. It does. It does in war. Morale matters. But that's all it is. We also have, of course, the announcement from the United States about the delivery of cluster bombs. And this has caused some controversy, you know, with Britain saying that they're not going to join them. They still disapprove of cluster bombs. But we also have this story. It's got two sides to it, I think. I think they're both very closely related. And that is that, you know, the United States, as the main arms manufacturer in NATO, is simply running out of supplies of ammunition. And so Ukraine is complaining about the lack of ammo. And I think we're literally in the situation of where the factories in the United States, and for that matter, in other parts of the world, simply aren't geared up for production yet on a sufficient scale to fight this war in Ukraine. So you have, for example, the strong arming by NATO, by the United States, for example, of South Korea, saying that you must supply Ukraine. I presume the same's going on with Japan, that for various constitutional reasons, they find themselves barred from engaging in a proxy war with Russia in Ukraine. That must be overcome in order to supply Ukraine with the necessary munitions. And what we've got in Ukraine, after all, is some sort of rerun of World War One, fundamentally a war of artillery plus troops holding land. So the artillery wins land, troops are then put in to hold the land. Costly in terms of human life, also costly in terms of the amount of shells that you have to fire every hour, every day. So the United States is supplying these weapons, I believe, on two bases. One, because actually the conventional artillery shells are running low. And two, very predictably, that the Ukrainian offensive is, well, should we be generous, is creeping. It's a whimper. There is no dramatic breakthrough, and no dramatic breakthrough should be expected. Now, I was prepared to change my mind on that assessment, which I've held for some considerable time now, not least when we were supplied, courtesy of the BBC, the FT, with satellite pictures of Russia putting in place massive, massive earthworks all the way along, not only the coastline of Crimea, but all the way up the front line between Ukraine and Russian forces, but also up the border between the two countries. So whether that goes all the way over in the north, I don't know, but all the way along the east, they've got defences. And it isn't just one line of defence, it's line after line after line of defence. So it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that the Ukrainian so-called offensive is proving to be, how should I put it, a damp squib, to be, not exactly a spectacular success. As I said, I was prepared to revise my view simply on the basis, yes, if the Wagner mutiny it was never going to succeed, but if that, for example, had a crushing effect in terms of Russian morale and Russian troops saying, sod that for a lark, we're going back home. If there were splits above in the FSB and the army, of course that didn't happen. This wasn't a pre-planned move to replace the presidency, to put a new regime in power. This wasn't, in my humble opinion, a CIA operation. It was a symptom. Okay, so under those circumstances, it's at least feasible to imagine Russian morale plummeting. On the other hand, there they are, they're well dug in, they're well defended, and at least in terms of my assessment, and I haven't read enough about cluster bombs, I don't see them being a game changer on the front line at the present time. you know, you've still got those dragon's teeth, you've still got those tank traps, you've still got line after line of trenches, and I presume concreted defence position, not just mud, but concrete. And so, yes, you know, these cluster bombs, if you're advancing without protection, and there you are, you're, you know, masses of troops, you can kill people on a huge scale. If you drop these cluster bombs, for example, on an airfield that isn't protected by concrete bunkers, then you could knock out, you know, dozens and dozens of aircraft, which of course are ultra thin skinned, and you'd simply destroy them on the ground. So yeah, using them, I presume, on unprotected aircraft in Crimea, that's a possibility. But on the other hand, if I was a Russian general or an Air Force guy, I'd be making sure that those planes are well protected. And I presume that they've done that as part of their preparations for the long flagged Ukrainian offensive. Either way, my assessment, for what it's worth, is this isn't going to be a game changer. Okay, you drop these particular munitions, it kills X people. You simply move new troops in those trenches. So you're still very well defended. How are you going to advance your Leopard 2 tanks over these dragon's teeth? These bombs are not going to destroy these concrete 4 feet high pillars. They're not going to destroy that. They can kill you, they can kill me. They can destroy an aircraft. They might be able to knock out one tank, two tanks, but they're not going to knock out a tank regiment or anything like that. So, okay, it's caused a political ripple, but I don't see it as anything more than that. And indeed, what I would say is the reason they're being supplied is because of logistical reasons in terms of factories, but also because of the poor showing, predictably poor showing of Ukrainian forces. And that isn't because they're not brave, isn't because they're well trained. It's just that the Russians are very well dug in. And as long as those troops hold their nerves, they can hold that ground, at least in my assessment. Okay. Couple of things now, we're coming to an end, so last quarter of an hour. We got a very good article in this week's paper on climate and the report of the Copernicus Institute, an EU subsidized body of scientists. And we got in the article how records are being broken. But as we were coming out, we had reports of even the records that we were reporting as records broken, they were being broken. So what we had last week was the hottest temperature since records began for 3 days in succession. Now, we're not talking about geological time. No. It was a lot hotter in the past. Sometimes it was colder. We're talking about meteorological records. And in terms of global temperatures, these don't go back to 1890 or 1850 or 17 something or other. You can get British reports of temperatures going way, way back. They've got tree rings, blah, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, what we're actually talking about here is records going back to 1979. Now, okay, this relies on a combination of satellite imagery and equipment and computer projection. So this isn't definitive data, but it's good data. It's the best data that we've got. And this is from the University of Maine in the United States. And their finding was that we had one, this is globally, by the way, not here in London or Manchester or here or particularly there. This is global. So a global average, we had 3 days, one after the other, highest, highest, and highest. And this has been backed up by the Copernicus Institute, saying that's a reasonable, estimate. It's a reasonable projection in terms of computers. But in terms of the official count, they count on an annual basis, not on a daily basis. Either way, of course, we need to take into account that this has two main causes. And of course, one of them is El Nino, or El Nino, I've got to get it pronounced right, which is the, I think it's a biannual cycle in the Pacific, which gives you sometimes colder temperatures, but this time warmer temperatures. And you add that to the human effect, the effect of industry, the effect of transport, the effect of shipping, and all the rest of it, and that is the result. So you could say it's a freak result, and I would shrug my shoulders and go, yeah. But it's also a warning. It's a warning about where we're going, because, of course, the El Nino will keep repeating, we would guess, every 2 years or whatever it happens to be. But meanwhile, in terms of emissions of CO2, of methane and other such greenhouse gases, that continues to increase. And all you need to do is look at this Tory government, let alone the right-wing press, and you can see where you're going. Now, quite frankly, as we said in the article, as Eddie Ford said in his article, we don't have an on-off switch. You cannot switch off global warming, because what you have is a situation that warming is built into the system. So if you did, for example, tomorrow enact the Paris Agreement from 2015, bang, there we are, carbon neutral, some sort of miracle, it's done, you would still have a situation of where those polar ice caps would get thinner and thinner, smaller and smaller, and the level of the ocean will get higher and higher. Does that mean that we are facing the extinction of the human beings as a species? No, it doesn't mean that. You know, if we look at the past, we know that human beings have lived through ice ages, but we've also lived through warm periods. There's no reason why we can't live through freezing conditions or warmer conditions. But what happens precisely in terms of our culture, which is incredibly delicate, it rests on global supplies, it rests on agricultural patterns, habitation patterns that have been established over a long time. You know, what will happen to us in a relatively short time? And so we're talking in historic terms, tiny time is cities being inundated, agricultural patterns being completely disrupted. And just as to illustrate that, what we had, not because it's an average, but what we had is temperatures approaching 50 degrees centigrade in Mexico, for example. And we do in certain parts of the world, therefore, if you haven't got, you know, air conditioning, for example, as an awful lot of people haven't, you literally reach the limit of human endurance. So in parts of China, the authorities were telling workers outside to stop work. And what we had in Mexico, where the authorities didn't tell people to stop work, maybe because of it was peasant small-scale farming, I don't know what, maybe it was in Mexico City, I don't know the details, but what we had is reports of 100 people dying. And so, yeah, in certain parts of the world, large numbers of people, especially people with this or that condition, will die as a result of that. But in the meantime, what we see is cities inundated with increasing frequency and therefore becoming uninhabitable. What you could have, and again, it depends how far you go, is a situation of where the American prairies turn to dust, for example. We don't know, because we don't know, you know, when you do switch the off button. We have pledges from governments. You could make projections, but we simply don't know. All you can say is the quicker you stop doing what you're doing now and you go over to a rational management of the economy, rational management of the Earth's resources, which I would argue requires socialism, which requires planning, then humanity is in for a very good chance. So I don't think we're facing extinction, but I do think that you could be facing something equivalent to, you know, the breakdown of various civilizations. Okay, last few things. Scotland, two cheers for the Scottish government. It's been saying that we should have legislation that makes the possession of illegal drugs not a criminal offence. Yes, you get involved in some relationship with the state that will send you on some rehabilitation course or whatever the hell it happens to be, the Portuguese solution. Why only two cheers? Because it still says that the supply of drugs is illegal. Well, how do you consume drugs if you don't have someone supplying you? And what I know, the limited amount that I do know about drugs, is that most people who have got a habit will know people who supply them, who also, chances are, will have the habit. And that doesn't mean Mr. Kingpin up there somewhere in, you know, Colombia or wherever, or mafia land, necessarily has a habit. But the lower you get on the ground, the chances are that they have a habit and they know a supplier that can supply more, that they can make a profit in order to finance their own habit. It's that sort of type relationship. So it's not uncommon for people who have a drugs habit to also be suppliers in order to finance their drug habits. Certainly, you know, some drug habits are mega, mega expensive. So I'm thinking, as I understand it, of cocaine, for example. Okay, so that's two cheers. So, for example, you know, I am a drug taker. I take alcohol. And, you know, when I go to the pub, I look at what's available. I go, oh, that looks nice. Oh, but on my first pint, I think I'll go for something weak. So I choose something that maybe is 3.7. So I can drink that to quench my thirst. And then when it comes to my third pint, I limit myself to three. Or I'll have something stronger. But I don't want to go to four pints because that gets me a little bit too, you know, I won't go on to whiskey because that will really do me in. So I'm able to choose my drug, its strength, its quality. And that's what should be the situation with recreational drugs, as it is with medical drugs. We need to know that this is good stuff. We need to know that it's safe. We need to know, even if you're being irresponsible, you need to know that you're being irresponsible. And you don't know that with drugs that you know, are supplied by the mafia or Colombian drugs cartels. That needs to change. And therefore, the supply question comes into it. That's why I'm giving them two cheers. But also I'm giving them two cheers because this is also about, at least from my assessment down here in London, about the Scottish SNP government, coalition government, keeping the constitutional question alive, that when they chose to fight on, you know, the trans issue, the gender recognition issue, that was a weak weak wicket, if that's not the wrong words. You get what I'm trying to say. That wasn't a strong, you know, place to fight the British government on. On the other hand, maybe, I don't know, other comrades can chip in and tell me what you think. Maybe drugs is. On the other hand, you look at the reaction of the mainstream parties, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm talking bollocks, because what we had from the Scottish Tories, you could have predicted it, you know, you don't need to, you know, you'd have guessed it already. This is madness, absolute madness. Because what have we got in Scotland? We've got last year, 1,330 people died as a result of drugs. Before, the year before, it was 1,339. And what we are told, that this is the highest in Europe. So, hey, Tories, making things illegal and criminalizing people. And I know in Scotland, it's more relaxed than it is in some other parts of the UK. But that's really working well at the moment, isn't it? So we have this war on drugs that clearly isn't working. It's making some people very rich, but it's also killing other people and making other people very poor, who go around robbing the likes of you and me in order to feed their very expensive drug habit. So, you know, if they've got a cocaine habit or a heroin addict or a crack habit, that's a very expensive habit to finance. So hence, illegal drugs is a way of financing it. Also robbing, street robbery, breaking into houses, that's also a way of robbing it. Okay, you predicted the Tories. You can also predict Labour, can't you? Rachel Reeves, on behalf of the Lab Cons, she also describes it as, don't think that's a good idea. No, Rachel, what you're doing now, that's the good idea, isn't it? No, the war on drugs has failed. Drugs ought to be legalized. We ought to have the same situation with tobacco and with alcohol, that you know what you're consuming. As far as we know, taking drugs goes back to human origins. We don't need to get into chimpanzees or elephants. But as far as we know, we've always done it. And I suspect we always will. We like a party. We like to use drugs to relax. We like to use drugs to stimulate ourselves for all sorts of good or bad reasons. And of course, we want the future society to use drugs for good reasons, not because people are despairing and giving up on life. So all you need to do, you know, as I did, is to look at when I went to the Soviet Union, just watching men, and it was men just drinking vodka to the point of where they were oblivious. So unpleasant was their living reality. And that's been true in Scotland as well. You know, people coming out of their workplace and the licensing hours, pint of heavy scotch, pint of heavy scotch, oblivion, go back home, beat up the wife, beat up the kids. No, we don't want that sort of drug taking. Okay, just very briefly now, in the last 1 minute, socialist worker, abolish the Met Police. We agree, comrades. Okay, what replaces the Met Police? The ordinary police force, a nice police force? They don't tell us. What we say is a people's militia, a conscript people's militia. Everyone does their bit of militia work. That was the program of social democracy in Russia, Lenin's party. It was the program of German social democracy. God's sake, it was the program of the Labour Party under Keir Hardie when it was formed. But nowadays, whether you're socialist appeal, the communists of socialist appeal, Socialist Party of England and Wales, whether you're the Socialist Workers' Party, Left Unity, none of them dare raise the question of a people's militia. Why? I don't know. Is it because they have taken the fun out of us for so many years for raising the question? I don't know. Either way, they talk about revolution, but they don't supply the means in order to exact such a revolution. Last point, Rishi Sunak, small boats, great focus group politics. What are the main issues that you think face Britain today? Tick, tick, tick. Oh, small boats, illegal migrants. Tick, we'll go with that. What sort of numbers are we talking about? Well, how's this sound? 200,000 migrants a year. No, 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 don't approve of that. And, you know, the tens of thousands, how's that appeal to you? Yeah, that sounds much better. Focus group. We'll put that in our manifesto. We'll put that on our five priorities. Great, great, great. But hey, Rishi, they still come. And your Rwanda thing isn't going to put people off. You're not going to be having hundreds. If you have anybody going to Rwanda, I'll be quite surprised. But you're not going to be putting hundreds of people there every day. It ain't going to work. You can put them on barges. People will abscond and they'll go into the black economy, but they will keep coming. Why? Because there's push. Because you're using that Anglo-Saxon word again. You're fucking up the Middle East. You're fucking up Africa. And people who want some sort of future want to get out of the living hell that they're in at the moment and therefore want to go to Europe. Why do they choose Britain? Listen to an interview. They speak English because that's the dominant language at the moment. So that's why they will keep coming. And that's why you will never solve the small boat problem. And if it ain't on small boats, it will be on big boats, as it was. They're called ferries underneath the channel on the train. Whichever particular form of transport it is, people will still keep coming. That's it.